This is the book club on the edge of forever, and today we're reading Neuromancer. I'm Van Velding.
I'm Dr. Isix.
I'm Jess.
I'm Sandy. Neuromancer was written by William Gibson. It's one of the early cyberpunk novels, so I'll keep this summary probably shorter and less colorful than we got from Isix last time. But in short, it is the indefinite future. States have mostly broken down. It's a near-ish future. It was written during the Cold War, so the Soviet Union is still around. But it is a near-ish future thing. States have kind of collapsed, and everyone is connected through what is called the Matrix. It's sort of an internet that you jack into. And the story focuses on Case, who is a hacker who, in true cyberpunk noirish fashion, stole from his partners and was punished by having his ability to hack removed via a Soviet mycotoxin. And as the story opens, he has been desperately trying to reverse the damage. He's ended up in Chiba, in Japan, where, as the novel's opening line tells us, the sky above the port was the color of television, tuned to a dead channel. That kind of sets the tone. So he is paranoid after his girlfriend, Linda, tells him, incorrectly, that his current employers want him dead. He encounters a cybernetically enhanced samurai with Wolverine-style retractable claws named Molly Millions and her employer Armitage, and they offer him a deal. They'll heal him, they'll reverse the damage to his nervous system, and if he does one job for Armitage, he'll be as good as new. So he has been living pretty close to the edge. He's been committing slow-motion suicide, taking on increasingly dangerous jobs. You know, he's become addicted to drugs, and he resists this initially, but he finally agrees to work with them. His girlfriend, Linda, steals and tries to fence some hardware from him. She's killed for it. And kind of, again, in sort of noirish fashion, this will haunt him through the rest of the novel. But he decides to channel this reasonably productively. And the first bit of hacking, which is described in very abstract fashion in the book, is for Case to disable the security systems that are guarding a digital recreation of McCoy Pauly, who is a legendary hacker. And Pauly will help Case through the rest of the story. And crucially, and I think this sets up, the story is it's science fiction, it's not, the science is a bit less there. But he is stored in read-only memory. Which means that if he is unplugged, if McCoy Pauly is unplugged, he doesn't remember anything. So he has to be left plugged in, otherwise he kind of resets. And so after they steal McCoy, Case is contacted by someone named Wintermute, who turns out to be an AI who's been created by the wealthy and reclusive Tessier-Ashpool family, who've been cloning themselves and cheating death through cryogenic stasis, because it is... There's very little in the novel that is really that far-fetched, but it's kind of this extrapolation of what was around in the 70s and 80s. So this family has created an AI for some reason, and Wintermute, the AI, explains that Armitage, the person who is brokering all of this plans that Case has signed up for, was a special forces soldier who was damaged, badly injured in a covert mission against the Soviet Union that, as it turns out, was just really a test. They were just kind of trying to see what the Soviet Union's defenses looked like, and they were willing to sacrifice these special forces soldiers for it. So he was badly injured, and his personality was reconstructed during therapy by the Wintermute AI, who is directing it. So Armitage is not really the person behind the operation, it's really this AI, Wintermute, and Armitage is slowly going crazy. He's reliving this disastrous final operation in the Soviet Union, and so after he kills himself, or sort of has himself killed, Wintermute's mission falls just on Case, Molly, and their allies. And it turns out that Wintermute is one of two AIs created by Tessier-Ashpool. Apparently because they were bored rich people, but the AIs have sort of grown into a life of their own. Wintermute has no personality of its own, and it wants them to break into Tessier-Ashpool's space station resort, which stores access to the other AI, which Wintermute wants to merge with, and this other AI is the titular Neuromancer. Neuromancer has a personality of its own, and it doesn't want to lose it to this merger, so it tries to convince Case in this digital world to stay there. It's recreated his girlfriend, Linda Lee. They have a discussion about, you know, whether he will stay there. Case says no. They go through with the final operation with Polly's help. And Polly, McCoy Polly, this construct, this digital recreation of this famous hacker, has agreed to help them only on the condition that his program be erased at the end of it. Because this existence, you know, if you heard that and you thought, that sounds kind of, I have no mouth and I must scream, McCoy Polly agrees. So he says, I'll help you, but you have to erase me afterwards. The rest of it is actually pretty simple. It's not particularly difficult for them to merge the AIs. So Wintermute and Neuromancer merge to create some kind of super AI, which then disappears to go do its own thing. It tries to find other intelligences in the universe. Molly and Case part ways. Case goes back to hacking. And the novel ends. He catches a glimpse of Linda, this digital recreation of her that Neuromancer had created. Neuromancer itself, and a third person who he believes is a simulacrum of him. And here's Polly's laugh, although Polly was supposed to have been deleted. But that's it. I mean, we don't really know what that means because the novel sort of ends there. It was the first of several, but that is the arc of the story is these two AIs who are pulling strings behind the scenes.
An ambiguous ending strikes.
Yeah, I generally liked it.
Me too.
I wanted to like it. My thing was that you know, first of all, before I go any farther, I should say, you know, I'm a fantasy guy, always have been. I love me some D&D, some swords and sorcery, and I get like there's the whole overlay of like, you know, what's magic and what's technology. But this book is like somebody who just would go in there and describe the complexities of casting several spells in extreme detail. Like there's a point where it stops being about the specific incident and it becomes like this exercise in describing a single forest. You know, like this is the origin of all magic and how all magic works. This novel felt that way to me.
You just recommended us a Brandon Sanderson novel, but okay.
I recommended the Brandon Sanderson
novel. Oh, you did? I'm sorry. I was perhaps confused because Josh has given me Stormlight Archive novel in the past, but that's my jam, personally. I like that level of detail. The irony is that I don't think Neuromancer has it.
I guess I'd have to agree to a certain point. Yeah, there's a lot of detail as far as actions being taken, but a lot of the technical details of the Matrix and all that is very abstracted. You're going around in sort of a 3D space, effectively, as Case is doing his thing there. And, you know, it's being described as, you know, there's these cities of lights and these cubes that are, you know, intrusion countermeasures and AIs and things like that. And we're getting sort of, I guess it's called Babbage phenomenon, you could say, where it's like there's a shark here that represents this thing. And, you know, there's people walking around and that sort of represents this. And so it's very, you know, these things represent complex programs, but yeah, you know, we're not seeing the code level at all. It's sort of,
not at all.
You know, it's almost like, you know, we're in a weird sort of video game sort of space.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason why I had put this novel in is because I was curious to see this was one of the cyberpunk novels. And I was curious to see how it held up. And I think one reason why it holds up sort of better than it has any reason to is because everything is so abstracted. And I think Gibson was himself, I don't think he was one of those really like early adopters of computers. I don't think he, you know, obviously he's not a programmer. And so there are very few of those descriptions of, you know, how things work or what the technology is or how fast it is or how much data is being transferred. There's one point where he talks about visualizing the data that kind of connects all of the cities, the data interlinks, and the numbers there are, I mean, high. They might actually be higher than the current, you know, current internet usage, you know, billions of bits a second or something like that. But I kind of feel like had there been more sort of focus on the protocols, had there been more focus on the technology itself, had there been more focus on what it looks like, then because this was, you know, Usenet, I think, Usenet existed at this point. People were dialing into BBSs. But the idea of one shared internet, because this is sort of like, well, I mean, it's sort of like Second Life, I guess. But it's sort of like the World Wide Web. That didn't exist. And so he was building it from scratch. And I think in some ways, the fact that it's so abstracted, what hacking looks like, what a virus looks like, I think that is that does help it. Because, I mean, I look to you know, Star Trek, where they kind of talk about, in the rare areas where they've talked about, you know, what a kiloquad is, or how fast somebody can process information. And I want to say it's something like data in the next generation has like the you know, a huge amount of memory, but he has like the processing power of like a Pentium 2 based on the flops that he's capable of processing. Like, so right. it doesn't, I think, can age more poorly.
Yeah.
Yeah, to a certain extent, you know, it does suffer a bit from Z-Rust, but I find that kind of charming to a degree. It's like, yes, you know, there is, you know, things that are very, you know, sort of anachronistic for, you know, how things ended up turning out. But, you know, it's still, as far as your world building here, it's all sort of like, it makes sense in the context of the story still. And so, you know, when you get things like mentioning an ancient Sony monitor, you know, a part of me is like, all right, so given what the time of this story is written, that's a CRT of some sort. But, you know, and he's a little silly sort of in retrospect, though I did visualize them as flat screens. Yeah, so there's a good bit of that here.
I think they are flat screens because that's like there's the bit at the end where he throws the shuriken at it and it like at the screen and it kind of like breaks, not like a CRT would, but like an LCD would. Like he kind of describes it as like it's reacting to the cut in it.
But Josh, you said it's got so much detail in it. Like, is there a specific scene that you're thinking of?
That's the thing, is that like, okay, like when I started this novel, like the first 2 hours, I was invested and I was very, very curious because I'm like, this is the origin of Shadowrun. Like, this is the origin of Cyberpunk. Yeah. Like, I'm getting all of that. Like, to me, like, this was hardcore, like, all of this stuff. Yeah. And I cannot honestly tell you at what point, but at some point, it was just my eyes glazed over and I'm like, I need to be listening to this audiobook. And like, I backtracked multiple times and then I went back after this book. Because I was like, okay, we reached a conclusion of some sort.
Yeah.
I don't remember that. I believe Jess might have a comment to ring in there. But I was like, I feel like I just sat through a thing that I just cannot understand and process. Because every time I would like go into this explanation of what something is, like my eyes would glaze over.
Was the part where they picked up Peter? Because that was pretty confusing. Because they go to Turkey to pick up the third member of their team, fourth member.
Peter Riviera.
Yeah, Riviera.
He was kind of an asshole, to put it lightly.
Yeah.
I remember clearly and understood the plot up to the point where he met Molly Millions in his cheap motel. And then they went through the whole process of making him whole again. And immediately after that, like, everything is just blurry.
To the and basically the end of part one, which I'd also kind of argue that that's kind of fitting that he's in sort of recovery mode, and so things are still a bit wobbly, and so we're kind of getting a third person perspective of a world that doesn't quite fit together and make sense to him quite yet.
I agree with you. Like, it's a lot of things happen there, and there's definitely a Grant Morrison-esque quality to it where it's like, I'm going to do story things and you're just going to keep up. And that works for Grant Morrison because he works in comics. And so there's a lot of visuals to help you like bridge that gap. The dude puts a lot of stuff in the gutters, I guess. And that definitely happens because a lot of things start happening at that point in the story where Molly is suddenly on Case's side against Armitage for reasons I don't understand. She starts working with the terrorists as part of their job. She's also setting up safe rooms. And they're also trying to determine if Case's neurotoxin countdown, like, it he's been fixed, but if he doesn't do the job, there's additional neurotoxin in him, and he's right back to where he starts, which is, there's a lot of technology here that serves the plot exclusively, and we're not supposed to question it too much. But yeah, a lot of things do start happening at that point, and you're not sure what thread the words you're reading are working on. In addition, they're throwing a bunch of new sci-fi shit at you.
I was never able to personally recover from that point. Like, I got, like, Sandy's synopsis of the book was spot on, and I can say I know what points Sandy was talking about when Sandy spoke of them, but if you asked me to do a synopsis on this book, I couldn't do one. Like, I mean, I remember the Rastafarians. There were some really cool characters. I liked the concept that the audiobook actor did a really good job of doing a Rastafarian accent. And, you know, like there was some really cool stuff in there. But I could not tell you, like, much more about this book. Jess, did you want to comment on what you thought about the end?
Josh and I did discuss this, so I'm trying to remember what he said. But I kind of understand what Josh is coming from, because I like, if there's a scene, I can remember the main action of the scene. I can remember like what Josh is saying, like what Sandy said is going on in it. But all the detail and all that kind of stuff, I don't remember any of that, because I felt like all the words were just a garble of like detail of trying to describe it. And so I kind of got, like he did, I kind of glazed through some of the scenes and had to kind of go back and listen again. I didn't realize what the ending was about until I could tell it was a different voice. And the reader was reading in the afterword, his, you know, like he had a different voice from the, when he was actually reading the book. I didn't realize it, because it just kind of rolled into that. And I didn't feel like it was a super definite ending.
Yeah, I had to reread a lot. I had to go back and reread things pretty frequently.
It's interesting. Like, I mean, I liked it, and I think it did. I read it, I think, 15 years ago, and I think it held up. Like, I still enjoyed it, but it's interesting. So I will say, one, it was probably obvious I had an outline written that I was reading from, because I also had to go back through and kind of reconstruct what had happened. And also, like, there are big chunks of the book that I just didn't, like, the Rastas, everything that happens on the space station, Peter, I didn't mention them in the outline because they don't really matter. Like, it's easy to just describe, like, I just call the Rastas, like, their allies, because they're interesting. Like, it's interesting that they have this backstory and that they exist, and the fact that there is this quasi-separate nation-state on a space station is sort of interesting, but it's not really relevant to the core plot. And yeah, I could see how the ending would be not necessarily unfulfilling if you realize it's the ending, but like the last 10% of the book is definitely pretty compressed. It's interesting, like listening to it, like hearing this discussion now, it is definitely weaker as a story, perhaps, than it is as an aesthetic driver of the cyberpunk genre.
Yeah.
Completely agree.
Indeed.
I think that what this book did, Neuromancer created the cyberpunk genre in a huge way. But the part of it is that it created the genre, but it left a lot of people who read it wanting something more because of how it was written. And I think that,
yeah, that's fair.
The creation of everything else that's on top of this. Like, everyone else was like, man, this thing was incredible, but there were these problems here. What if we did it this way and we created our own thing?
That's an interesting way to frame it. I would say it feels like the story is a walking tour of the world. So it focuses on world building and aesthetics that it does very well. And that's the basis I think a lot of people took and ran with, because the story is, dude is special. Dude is coerced into a job. Dude fucks girl, because William Gibson is as straight as, what was the guy last week? Jim Butcher. And... and then, you know, good guy wins, bad guys die. Everything's great forever. We disrupt the system in some vague, non-specific way.
I have to ask a question. Is that good?
Remind me to suggest more books with gay sex in it, then. Just for the future reference.
I'm down.
Yeah, we need to get the Samuel Delaney quote.
It's not like a big make or break deal for me, but it's just a noticeable trend.
I have to ask a question. Did Case's character grow at all in this novel?
That's interesting.
I mean, he leaves, he goes back to frickin' Chiba, and then starts doing drugs again after getting his liver and pancreas replaced again.
I swear to God, I don't even know what Case does in the novel. He piggybacks a transaction request from LA to the place that they're knocking over, which is an instance of actual hacking. And then he's like, we're going to have to go back and pass that over in post to make the hack work. And I'm like, yes, hacking. And but then at the end, he's like, Chinese super program, soul of a dead hacker. And then he feels feelings really hard at the ice wall at the end. It's not an ice wall, but it's like whatever the last line of defenses are. He feels feelings at it a lot. And then that lets him hack it. I don't even know why he's on the team.
I don't think he does necessarily grow. And this is something that I don't know if Gibson did it on purpose. He might have, because I think Molly is Gibson's recurring character. She was the one who showed up first, and she's the one who shows up later. But Case is not a particularly good I mean, like, he's decent, but it's said in the novel, I think McCoy Pauly tells him, like, you're pretty good, but you're not, like, the best. And I don't know whether It's possible that Wintermute also picked him because he thought he would be, or it thought that he would be psychologically susceptible, the same way that it picked Armitage, which it also was wrong about, and Peter, which it also was wrong about. So it's possible that that was part of the point, was that Case was sort of an unremarkable junkie.
I mean, like, I think there's an argument that can be made that like, the whole thing about this dystopian fantasy or dystopian sci-fi, right? And I think that, like, there's a point where you can go, his character didn't grow because that's part of this dystopia. Like, he's going back to the natural creature comforts of, like, who he is and what he wants to do. Like, maybe that's what he was trying to convey with that message. But, like, to me, it's just like, you know, like, you expect to, I guess with the whole, you know, Hero of a Thousand Faces thing, you expect a change, and maybe this is William Gibson intentionally turning that trope on its head.
I realized Case wasn't doing anything for our story, narrating it about halfway through.
Well, I would say that Case was kind of important for the first hack, where they're getting the Dixie flatline heist there sorted out. But for the final heist there, his contribution is less about hacking and almost like a distraction for Neuromancer, honestly, that Neuromancer seems convinced that he's the key to preventing this, that if, you know, he's distracted and or killed or something like that, this process will not transpire. But things have kind of been automated enough that, you know, without Case, things would still progress. You know, there might be complications, but they'd still probably happen in the end. And so Case is sort of, it looks like the weak link here, but he's red herring.
I think if you wanted to be charitable, you would say that Case is the defining moment, like the turning point for him is towards the end, because he's somebody who lives in the Matrix and, you know, this is his life, this is very important to him, and he's someone who carries a lot of guilt over Linda's death, because Neuromancer tells him that she wasn't killed for her association with him, but she stole something from him and went to fence it in the hopes that he would go after her and you know, feels something for her, and he feels guilt about what happened to her. And you have that scene where Neuromancer has recreated her, which we are given to understand is a faithful recreation, the same way that McCoy Pauly says. And Neuromancer says, stay with me in this world that I've created. Like, this is the Matrix that you love so much. Stay here. And he says, no, I don't want to do that. I don't like this place. He doesn't do it in a sort of kind of cliche, like, no, the real world is more important.
Right.
But it is something that, from what we know about him, we could have said, like, this abstraction, this thing that absolves you of what happened to Linda and that puts you keeps you in the Matrix is maybe what you wanted, and it is a simpler answer. And he says no.
It could be.
Yeah, I guess it is kind of a he's learned that maybe things on the real world are important too. you know, he complains early on about, you know, the meat being, you know, superfluous and all that. But, you know, and so, you know, he's all about the Matrix, but he's been out of it. He's jonesing for it. But once he sort of goes through this whole process, you know, it's sort of like, oh, well, maybe there's stuff outside too. Maybe I want some of that.
I don't know if I buy that, but like, it's reasonable. I don't know if he needs a character arc.
One of the things that gets me too is that, like, we keep talking about it, and the only reason I keep bringing up to it, right, is that, like, I like titles to mean things, right? And like, we haven't even discussed what Neuromancer was, and I feel like the description of what Neuromancer was one of those things that was like glazed over. Because I remember, like, specifically going, oh, Neuro, and, like, they go, it explains that its whole thing is that it copies human consciousnesses and creates the ROM and loads them up so that it can keep them for forever, right? And, like, that is one of those things where it's just, like, a blip. Like, it doesn't really go too much more into, like, anything else about that besides the fact that it was able to copy Linda and could copy Case. And that was it. Like, it was just kind of one of those things where it's like, oh, this is the big reveal. And it kind of falls a little flat for me. You know, like, if you're going to title your book after this whole concept, it seems like that was one of those things that they should have expounded upon more. Or maybe they did expound upon it more. And maybe William Gibson did. And I just missed it.
It wasn't like that concept is pretty low key. We accept it quickly from Polly. And then Rio is hinted at, but not really front and center till the very end. And even then, not super front center for that long.
I think possibly because the genre was kind of nascent. The way it's phrased is sort of that Wintermute is very kind of like our version of machine learning. It's capable of kind of making decisions and analyzing data. But again, a lot of its predictions are wrong. A lot of its like ways of pulling the strings are wrong because it doesn't understand consciousness. It doesn't understand how people really work. Whereas Neuromancer is the opposite. Neuromancer is operating from much more limited data, but it does have a personality of its own. It has desires of its own. And it comes off being somewhat childish in that way, and its avatar in the digital world is a child. But I think that was supposed to be the difference, that Wintermute was data without personality, and Neuromancer was personality without maturity.
Indeed.
Makes sense.
That does.
So for our listeners, to give it a little bit more explanation, there is a by the Tessier Ashpool folks to basically upload their consciousnesses into Neuromancer and then let Wintermute effectively affect all the changes and decisions in the real world for their company/family. And so they live on effectively forever in this sort of construct world while their bodies/infrastructure is protected by Wintermute. And so they sort of need both of these components here in order to enact this sort of grand plan here. But, you know, there were some disagreements in the family, and, you know, the person that was heading things up, the mother, kind of expired.
She got murdered by the Tesher side of the Tesher Ashpool clan?
I thought it was the Ashpool. But
okay, I'm not great with proper nouns.
Was Lady 3 Jane that did that?
No, this is the original matriarch who had the concept and began executing on the concept. But okay. She was murdered by her husband before she could finish it. So you end up with these two AIs that are very different, which know one of them knows they're supposed to be together as part of a cohesive whole. But because of her death, they aren't there, and it needs Armitage et al. To merge them together to finish its programming, like V'ger.
Yep. Yeah, this does kind of get to what I wanted to talk about a bit is that final sort of combination there. You know, it's not entirely clear if Wintermute and Neuromancer were fully united into a single consciousness because there's still sort of components there, but it is also sort of what they were kind of seeking there. And I guess it kind of also comes down to what kind of AI is this, given that it has these sort of components here. There's a lot of thought in the science fiction and, you know, also, you know, computer programming sort of areas, like, all right, so if we build a true AI, how is it going to think, not just in terms of the actual processes we go through, but you know, what is its motivations going to be? And they talk a little bit about it in the story there, that an AI can have very alien sort of motivations built into it that we as human beings can't possibly comprehend. And so trying to predict its behavior is kind of foolhardy. We sort of learn more about these two entities, we can kind of get a better feel of what they're trying to do overall. Kind of clear what the new means for the unified construct gestalt, whatever there is, other than what it tells us, which you never know if it's going to be true or not. So I wondered if anyone had any thoughts there.
The AI police, I forget what they're called. They have some opinions.
The Turings.
The Turings, yes. Yeah. They have some opinions on that. Because they seem to wave in front of us. I don't know if something I added to that solution or was something they say explicitly. The stakes of this is an unshackled AI, and that's bad. I don't think they explain to us why it's bad. But, for us reading, I think we all intuitively understand unshackled, self-improving AIs are maybe bad for the human race.
Given, once again, we don't know what its motivations are, it'll all humans because more, and they're actually going to be more trouble than they're worth. And, well, that would be kind of bad for all of us here. And so it's sort of the assume a worst-case scenario situation.
Right. Our heroes do, by the way. They finish that quest, get their XP, and don't think a thing about it. No consequences.
Hey, they got paid, and I can use the Matrix now.
Yeah. But luckily for our heroes, it seems benevolent and honest.
Yeah.
Whatever the end result is.
Indeed. Doesn't seem out to get anyone just yet. So
but what it wants is beyond our comprehension, as Isaac said. Because it's like there's the bit where it's like, I'm looking for others like me, and Case says, well, there aren't, like, we haven't detected them. And the super AI says, well, yeah, because you can't, like, you don't think in the right ways, you're not looking for the right things. Nobody knew what to look for until I existed. So it is sort of a becoming an elder god that defies our comprehension.
Right. I think the culture series has the concept of minds, capital M minds, which are it's super advanced self-improving AIs which run the culture. You know, like that's a possibility, because they seem fairly powerful and benevolent.
Sort of the dawning of a new sort of ecosystem, a new way things, operates. Some sort of, perhaps even a brave new world, but that's a different story.
You know, I've never really accepted the hand-wavy, oh, it's an AI, we couldn't understand its goals. It's very hard to do that, I think, in fiction. I look forward to the book that does it well, because you either say, it wants whatever it wants, therefore I can have it do anything I desire as a storyteller, which seems like a bit of a cop-out, or you say, hey, it actually wants concrete things. It's not that alien. It wants to find other AIs like itself. It's going to find and utilize resources available to it to achieve that end, even if that end may be 20, 100 years in the future, even if that may be a set of assumptions that we're not privy to. But if, the AI goes, oh, here's the Drake equation, we're going to find aliens. Aliens will probably be like this. Here's a probability envelope of all this that I'm going to act within. And we're like, well, then it's just operating on assumptions that we don't have. And it's still not entirely alien. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, though, it is kind of interesting to think about AIs that have very straightforward and concrete motivations that seem to suggest much more ambiguous or grand ones. And so you get a computer that's like, all right, I need to fill the entire country of Uruguay with servers, and only Uruguay. And like, okay, we do this. What are you going to do with that? It just never tells you, because the truth is, that's his whole motivation, is just to fill the country of Uruguay with servers.
It's a paperclip maker.
Yes.
Well, it's not just that. Like, I think that you kind of like touch on the whole thing of, the Cthulhu mythos. I know they continue to bring it up. I love it. You know, it's one of those things where, if an ant starts suddenly chanting your name and it asks you to make this other ant important to you, you can do that by killing all the other ants. So, like, the other ant didn't want that, but it didn't understand that you couldn't do anything different because you just can't understand that level of consciousness. So, like, it could want you to fill up the entire country of Uruguay because in 10,000 years, it's planning on having that be a dumping ground for all ancient technology. Mm-hmm. And we would never be able to comprehend that. Like, I think that there's very, like, having it do those weird and strange things, like, open the gateway for thought, you know, like the reflection of what these things actually are doing and why they're doing them. And that is intriguing because that makes you question it, you know, like that's one of those things where it's like the whole, you know, Piranesi thing of it hangs around in your head for a while because you're wondering what the fuck did it want to do with all these computers.
And yeah. Products? And I'm not going to argue your example. I'm going to go to the ant and the person thing where it's like the ant has limited cognitive abilities, but we are sentient and, you know, sentience is sentience. And now maybe there is something beyond that, some kind of meta consciousness, which is great, but we can't, you know, with when we talk about objects that exist in four dimensions, like a tesseract, we can analogize where, well, how do three-dimensional objects appear to two-dimensional people, and therefore four-dimensional objects appear to us? By analogy, we can only see certain facets of any specific time. When you say, well, what's the next level of, there's no analog for that. Did you, it thinks more better.
I would argue that that's actually the thing, right? Because like technically speaking, like one of the things that's recognized, or at least on my understanding of it, and again, I'm not an expert. I think you're the physics expert here.
Dr. Isaacs is the physics expert here because he didn't go to 8 years of physics school.
Yes.
to not be, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Isn't the fourth dimension considered time? Wouldn't a higher level consciousness just have a better understanding of how things unfold across expanses of time that are too large for us to comprehend? I mean, the human mind, one of the things we talk about all the time is that, like, okay, so the national debt is X trillion dollars. Like, you can't understand that number because we don't have the capability to rationalize that. Like, that's just a random number that's thrown out to us because that's the best we can do to accept it. A higher level consciousness will not only be able to understand that, but it also be able to understand the effect of those over a longer period of time in a much more clear and better way than what we currently do. At least that's my argument, is, you know, like that level of consciousness would be the next step up.
Well, I suppose there's sort of a alternative way to sort of, you know, work with consciousness, that there's, you know, looking at that fourth dimensional spatial objects, so that, you know, there is length, width, breadth, and super depth there, as opposed to time. Having it visually looked at is tricky, but you can still define it mathematically. And so there are potentially ways, without jumping to a new level of consciousness, to redefine how you sort of want to study these things in order to better understand them. And so you could maybe say that that's the next level of consciousness and that there's maybe things beyond it. But I think that's more of a different, taking a different perspective and emphasizing different ways of understanding over others that make things more processable. Now, that said, you know, then you have to sort of push the, you know, limits of things that aren't so easily defined, you know, and by just changing your perspective then, in order to perhaps find things that a higher level of consciousness would be useful for. And, well, I'm no, you know, metaphysical expert there, so, you know, this is where I go before.
I guess my definition for this, I feel like maybe we're getting in the weeds, is you want something, you have facts, yes, and then you take actions based on those premises to accomplish what you want. And whether you know, you can perceive electromagnetic waves or the fourth dimension, like that's the same level of intelligence. It's just that an AI would have a much broader perspective, but it would still have things at once. It would have a large collection of facts. It would generate a premise, and then it would take actions to get that. To me, that's just scale. That's not a level of consciousness. That's just more conventional consciousness. But like the ant analogy holds though, where it's like, what if there was a consciousness of that consciousness that we can't think of because it's just alien to us.
Okay, I get what you're saying. Yeah, I can see that.
Perhaps in the ant analogy, yeah, the super AI is something that could be the ant that chants the name of you. That we, as every other ant, you know, are still as generally scaled as that ant, but the AI has reached this point where it can at least formulate, you know, the concept that I could call out to the grand Uber being that's above us here in order to try to communicate and get it, you know, to do things we want. Maybe the AI should be viewed as a tool to access that, not necessarily that level itself.
I should put up a fire upon the deep for the next round of books. Sandy, did you have a point you wanted to cover?
So as I said, I wanted to see how it held up in a world like written before the internet. I think a lot of it, you know, seems like reasonable extrapolations. Like if you think about like what about the future did this predict? The computer that he talks to is sort of like a, you know, like a Siri or an Alexa. It's kind of a very simple, like there is no sense that it is an actual AI, the Hosaka he uses. But what occurred to me was like it was written in the 80s. Maybe it's a Gen X thing. Gibson seems to have believed the future would have been would have been a lot weirder than it turned out to be. Like people have the Matrix, people the ability to modify their bodies, and you have this like transhumanist element of just doing weird things with it. Peter has the, you know, the holographic projector built into his body that he uses to do weird magic shows, and you know,
fucked up shit.
He can kind of, yeah, like, yeah, fucked up shit. But you know, you have like the hackers that they were, the terrorists that they work with early, the Panther Moderns, I think, who are like modify their bodies to look really weird, and there's like this sense of things being a lot like, given that freedom, people don't just recapitulate the world that they already have. They do interesting things with it. They do strange new things with it. And you know, he was writing before, I mean, Second Life, I guess. But it does feel like he was maybe expecting the internet to get people to do, or to get people to behave differently, to try new things, to invent themselves and reinvent themselves and kind of go wild. And we do, I guess, see some of that. But I don't know that Gibson's, I think what Neuromancer failed to anticipate was the degree to which the internet connectivity would change society, but not in the people turn themselves into ugly, you know, monsters because they want to just be provocative way. I mean, at least physically.
It homogenizes society, it doesn't diversify it.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, we of course, like, there are, the internet has created subcultures that are interesting and weird. And, you know, I look at, you know, I look at, like, Zoomer humor, like, on TikTok, and I don't understand it. It is very weird. but weird in a different way. Like, I think that his vision, what was missing from his vision of the future, in the foreword of the version that I have, he talks about failing to anticipate the end of the Soviet Union and how that was a kind of a big thing it was like a simple error that he didn't have to, it was an unforced error. Yeah. But I think the big thing that he missed is what the internet would actually look like. And in fairness, you know, he was not the only one. I think like Snow Crash is also an early cyberpunk written, yeah, I think, before the World Wide Web. I think it was 91 or 92, that also has this vision of an internet that we plug into, and that, you know, things are different. And it has aged into an aesthetic sense of what the 80s looked like, I guess. And some of that is maybe it wasn't supposed to be predictive. The fact that, you know, Case is a smoker. Is he a smoker because it was written in the 80s? That's what people did. Is he a smoker because he is sort of a noir character? But it's the weirdness. It's the weirdness that I think is missing from the weirdness that is missing from today that was predicted there. The more inventiveness was what occurred to me.
I mean, as a teacher, I will tell you that people are really weird. Little kids are weird. I see a lot of weird.
Yeah, I aspire to be strange, but I'm being outdone.
No, I understand, like, the direction. It's not weird or inventive in terms of what I think Sandy is saying. But kids are quite weird today, and because of the internet, and because they can have access, yeah, to all this things that we didn't have access to, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, adult shit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I it's interesting because one of the points I was thinking about covering was seminal cyberpunk novel, or cyber nor punk. And I hadn't thought about the angle of the body modifications and the electronic implantation definitely undersells, or at least ignores, the degree to which we like conventionality and we're going to stick to it. Like, things could be a lot worse right now in the way people use the internet, and a lot of things continue just because people haven't decided to act on it and to use it and to incorporate it. where you talk about deep fakes and scams and passwords. You know, in this version of the future, it isn't just that there's more technology, but that everybody's really cool with it, and it's almost mundane. And that is kind of subversive.
People have gotten used to the quirks of it all.
And to say maybe the world will be radically changed for the better by technology, which is what happens in this book. In the end, the climax feels like kind of a footnote, actually. Like, you know, the moral dimensions of what we do in the end is really a footnote, but it is anti-conventionality in text and subtext. So maybe that's why these people seem so much more ready to embrace this stuff than we are in reality.
I guess that's sort of, you know, an interesting comparison then between our, you know, heroes and the sort of the Tessier Ashpool folks. You know, these rich folk family that lives in basically a space castle that has been sort of, it's in space. It is on a space station. It is a sci-fi playground, and yet they keep stuffing it full of things that are very old school, conventional, that are being literally cut to fit in the space station so that, you know, it gives them a sense of home or something like that. Something familiar and old school.
It is a hoarder's sky palace.
Yeah. and so this is sort of a, all right, you know, even in this point in time are, the folks that are trying to hold on to sort of this conventionalized sort of view of what should be are having to compromise to a certain degree in order to keep up their facades there. While those that are much more flexible and willing to embrace technology and it can do things, they're not just sitting in cryogenic freezers forever. They're not, you know, cutting up beautiful doors in order to fit it in the right frame here. They're, you know, able to basically create a whole new computer being via a very convoluted plot. Things are progressing there, while the Tessier Ashpool are just kind of there, stagnant, decaying, frozen.
That's a really good point.
And dying.
I picked up on the Tessier Ashpool, you know, penchant for things of the past, the BoJack horsemanship of it all. You know, I hadn't really thought to reconcile that beside the world outside yet. Weirdly like Stormfront, which I didn't like that much. Both of them are a story about a fairly generic protagonist who's good at a thing, who gets pulled into all of this action with personal stakes. A little less so in Stormfront's case. And, you know, Harry Dresden is motivated to do the right thing, whereas Case isn't. Harry Dresden's a lot more active than Case is. The worlds are both kind of alien, and we seem to have some obligatory romantic entanglements, and then we kind of go out and we have a good time. But I feel like the ending of Stormfront was way better constructed, to the point where it's a little saccharine, but sugar has been well processed by a machine that's good at processing sugars, whereas Neuromancer just kind of resolves. Congratulations, you have saved the president. You were a bad enough dude.
You were a bad enough dude. Yeah.
That definitely hits the, yeah, that completely hits.
I mean, look, I got a little of a glimpse when he talks about never seeing Molly again, because that's kind of what you expect from her. And Case just goes back to doing regular Case stuff, like who gives a shit about him?
Yeah, I think Molly is a character who, again, she shows up in other books, and I think that's I think she probably is closer to the main character, even though she's not the perspective character. Right. Because there are bits of her, like there's the bit where she's like, I can't cry because like my eyes have been covered over by these lenses, so it like I have to like I either have to spit or I have to swallow my tears. And she's kind of like she has this kind of, you know, badass cybernetically enhanced samurai thing, but her backstory is not great, somewhat tragic, and it does feel like she has internalized that. It does feel like she is more well-rounded than Case cares about, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I think that is possibly why, like, yeah, that is a little unsatisfying, just because it would have been nice to see more about her.
In learning about her background, all I can think about is there's a web comic called Short Pact, which has its own story, but occasionally they'll just do random cutaways. And one of them is Frank Miller in a warehouse with a single light bulb above him, a typewriter in front of him, and he's surrounded by shadowy figures. And They put a gun to his head and they say, Frank Miller, you have to write a story about a female and she is not a whore. And they, and so he sits there and he sweats for a minute and he types W. And the next panel, he's just horse. Like, he just can't not do it. And it's like, I don't know if we need a female character. I don't know if we need all these female characters with some kind of sexual thing in their background. Like, I get that men run the world and we're terrible, but at the same time, like, just one that's not...
It is a trope that is, yeah, overplayed.
I mean, in all fairness, when this book was written, it wasn't as common a trope as we see today, I would think.
For some reason, the sexual content in Dresden Files felt less mature than this. And I don't want to say, oh, it's just because it's slightly more detailed. Like, that seems...
Well, I guess there's sort of a difference in what's being sort of, you know, emphasized. The Dresden Files was much more male-gazy overall. While, you know, in Neuromancer, it's like, all right. And so she was... You know, sure, there's some, you know, descriptions of, you know, their bodies being entangled, but there's also very much like, all right, well, this time we just kind of got busy and then next thing happens. So it's, you know, it's emphasized at times, but not others, I guess.
Yeah, I think what separates it for me is one, yeah, Molly is kind of, well, one, Molly is probably the most fully realized character in the book. But also, so there's the one sex scene that occurs kind of in the beginning, like occurs just after they've met. And I think it actually does a pretty good job of working within the plot, because Case is at that point a very atavistic, like hedonist, trying to destroy himself person. And it's written sort of kind of metaphorically, like you would expect him to be somebody who's chasing this the same way that he's using drugs, but it's written as a kind of a callback to what his, like what he actually wants, which is to be able to jack back into the Matrix, and also that Molly is kind of expressly looked at as an object by the, you know, by their sociopath hacker friend Peter. And that's like clearly bad.
Yeah.
So I think that's partly why it feels different.
Neuromancer has elements that keep popping up at things that I'm very familiar with, like Shadowrun. Oh yes, the Street Samurai, yeah. The deck specifically. And you know, a lot of the sort of visual stuff there as well, and you know, it just sort of like stuff, you know, here and there, and it's just sort of when I was reading this, like, hey, I know what that is, Abe, without sort of getting the description from the book of what this is all about, and you know, because it's my so in the very, you know, decades later sort of view here, it was kind of interesting as far as this my first exposure to it, that I guess maybe I was less wowed, but also less lost on some elements. A reader when this first came out might have been so, but just want to mention that.
I 100% agree. I think that this is one of those books where it helped define a genre, created an entire culture around itself, and was divisive enough that other people chose to build on top of it and make it this icon, this cultural icon in the background, you know, the zeitgeist.
I guess we're doing final thoughts now. I thought it was good. I enjoyed reading it. I don't think it's great. If you'd have put this in a lineup of books, I don't know if I would say this is going to make a genre.
Yeah, I myself enjoyed it. Yeah, I guess I was less lost than some of the other folks here. But you know, there's a certain sort of rhetorical poetry sort of Gibson's been used in this book that I really jived with and was able to sort of slide through it super easy. And I guess it doesn't work for everybody, but yeah, this is maybe something to try out.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be for everyone.
Yeah. I liked it a lot. And I think it is to Gibson's credit as an author that as something that was seminal in a genre that didn't really exist, and that he was not, you know, he wasn't a computer scientist. I think it's to its credit, that it has aged a lot better than, you know, like the Jetsons or some other kind of future looking vision of the world.
I mean, I enjoyed the story overall, but I wouldn't say it was a favorite that I've read in the last year or two or 10 or 20. Our next book is Edge Dancer. It actually comes out of the Stormlight Archive by Brandon Sanderson. It's a novella from the Stormlight Archive. So it's its own little story. And it's about a girl named Lif and how she is awesome and how she helps out in her own awesome way. I don't want to give too much away.
No, I get you. That's how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Velding.
I'm Dr. Essex.
And I'm Cindy.
I'm Josh.
I'm Jess.
Thanks for listening.
Case was about to hack the Gibson, but then he got high. Case was going to tear down Jesse Ashpool, but then he got high. Etc., etc.